This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega, and after 2 weeks away from the show, I'm really glad to be back with you all today. I hope everyone enjoyed their Labor Day weekend. And we have some new listeners with us this week. I want to formally welcome New Hampshire Public Radio. We're so glad to be with you, and we'll let you know this hour how you can stay in touch with us off air. We begin the show today with the confirmation hearings for Brett Kavanaugh, the man President Trump nominated to be the newest Supreme Court justice. The day did not get off to a smooth start.
I welcome everyone to this confirmation hearing on the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh.
Mr. Chairman.
To serve as Associate Justice.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to be recognized for a question before we proceed.
Regular order, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Chairman.
I'd like to be recognized to ask a question before we proceed. The committee received just last night, less than 15 hours ago, 42,000 pages of documents that we have not had an opportunity to review or read or analyze.
You're out of order. I'll proceed.
We have been denied real access to the documents we need to advise.
Mr. Chairman, regular order is called for.
Which turns this hearing into a charade and a mockery of our norms.
Executive privilege has never been invoked to block the release of presidential records to the Senate during a Supreme Court nomination.
From Judge Kavanaugh.
This is the first confirmation hearing for a Supreme Court justice I've seen, basically, according to mob rule.
We cannot possibly move forward, Mr. Chairman.
I extend
this hearing.
A very warm welcome
we have not
to
been
Judge
given
Kavanaugh.
An opportunity. Have a meaningful
his wife,
hearing
Ashley.
On this nominee.
You, sir, have
Chairman,
labeled
I'd
committee confidential.
You should be transparent.
We should not be proceeding until we have a response, and these documents have been available. It is 102,000 documents.
Every single one of our colleagues in the Senate Judiciary Committee on the Democratic side have announced their opposition to this nominee even before today's hearing. So it's hard to take seriously their claim that somehow they can't do their job because they've been denied access to attorney-client or executive privilege documents.
Senate Democrats came out on the offensive, delaying opening statements by more than an hour. The sticking point? The Trump administration is citing executive privilege to withhold more than 100,000 pages of documents from Brett Kavanaugh's time as a lawyer with the George W. Bush administration. Kavanaugh is currently a circuit judge in the Court of Appeals in Washington, D.C., and would fill Justice Anthony Kennedy's spot on the bench. If confirmed, the ideological balance of the Supreme Court would tilt to conservatives, and with the stakes high, protests also punctuated the hearings.
The framers intended for the judiciary to be immune from the political pressures the other two face.
Judge Kavanaugh is one of the most distinguished judges. Mr. Chairman, I think we ought to have this loudmouth removed. I mean, we shouldn't have to put up with this kind of stuff. I hope she's not a law student.
I've got two people here to help me break down these supreme stakes. David Ladd is back with me in the studio. He's an attorney and the founding editor of Above the Law, a legal news website. Hi, David.
Hi, Tanzina.
And we've got Byron Tao, a congressional reporter for the Wall Street Journal, and he's joining us from the Senate Press Gallery. Byron, great to have you on.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start with you, Byron, and I want to talk about the 100,000-plus pages of documents being withheld. First of all, can the president even do this? I mean, even if these documents are not set out for public review, is he even allowed to prevent fellow lawmakers from viewing these documents?
So the short answer here is yes. They're claiming, they being the White House, are claiming executive privilege on this batch of about 100,000 documents from Brett Kavanaugh's time as staff secretary in the George W. Bush White House. And that's essentially a doctrine that says that sensitive documents, internal deliberations within an administration, can be shielded either from the public or from Congress or even in some cases the courts. So this has been a long-running fight over executive power for a long time. But by and large, the courts have upheld this doctrine, and Congress has pretty limited options here to force their disclosure.
Is this unprecedented in terms of a confirmation process for a Supreme Court justice?
Well, that's a good question. You know, the thing about Kavanaugh is he comes with an interesting record, and he spent a lot of time at the White House. And so his time there generated a lot more of these documents than, say, other Supreme Court nominees in the past. So Democrats are saying that it's unprecedented to have so little insight into a large trove of documents from a nominee's professional history. On the other hand, Republicans are saying that these are particularly sensitive documents that tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands, even millions of other documents have been turned over, and that the public has a pretty good idea of who Brett Kavanaugh is, even without this trove of about 100,000 documents.
Well, I would argue that a Supreme Court appointment is also a pretty sensitive thing for the American public. David, I'm curious about the National Archives have released some of the documents from his time in the Bush White House. What have you seen so far? What have we learned?
So thus far, Tanzina, we haven't seen anything terribly exciting, I think, in these documents. We have seen Kavanaugh providing advice to the president and his President Bush, that is, and his administration, as we expected. There are many documents, as we were just discussing, that are shielded by executive privilege. For example, Kavanaugh commenting on judicial nominations, like the one that he now has. But we haven't seen any sort of smoking guns in the documents so far. There's nothing that has been released to date that strikes me as something disqualifying or that will really provide enough ammunition to opponents of Judge Kavanaugh.
Mm. Byron, the Republican majority in the Senate is, I mean, I don't think you can get any slimmer than a 50-49 now that John McCain has passed. That leaves Majority Leader Mitch McConnell with very little room for error. Who are the key votes here, Byron?
So on the Republican side, the two key votes to watch are Susan Collins of Maine and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. Both of them broadly are pro-abortion rights and have been seeking assurances from Kavanaugh on the topic. Now, Kavanaugh has said in some of these meetings with senators that he believes Roe v. Wade is settled law, but that's something that other nominees in the past have said, and he's by and large avoided commenting directly on cases or controversies, as is tradition with other nominees. So it's really unclear how he would rule on an abortion case that came before him. But those are definitely the two senators to watch, and that's the key issue on the Republican side.
David, give us a little bit of the background on Kavanaugh. We mentioned some of it, the top line, really, at the top of the show. But what kind of justice would he be, or is he expected to be, on the bench? And how would he fill the Kennedy shoes? I mean, Kennedy was a swing vote. Can we expect Kavanaugh to be a swing vote if confirmed?
So I think that a Justice Kavanaugh would be a much less of a swing vote than Justice Kennedy, for whom he actually clerked many years ago. He has an impeccable resume. He graduated from Yale College, a law school. He clerked for the Supreme Court for Justice Kennedy. He was a partner at a law firm. He served in the Bush administration. He's been a judge on the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals for now about a dozen years. In terms of his record, it is staunchly conservative. Less room for divergence, I would say, than Justice Kennedy. If you look at Judge Kavanaugh's 300 or so opinions during his dozen years on the appeals court, you will see mainly what we would regard as staunchly conservative rulings. Even though I think Judge Kavanaugh and many others will say, well, I'm not really conservative or liberal. I'm just calling the cases as I see them. But by conventional standards, this is a judge with a very conservative viewpoint.
Now, we're not in a conventional moment right now, politically, if you will. I mean, the president, David, is under, to put it lightly, tremendous scrutiny. There, his campaign is being investigated by a special counsel. Several of his associates have pled guilty. Some Democrats are suggesting that the convictions of Paul Manafort and Michael Cohen mean that the Senate should hold off on voting for Kavanaugh until the special counsel investigation into Trump is over. I don't even know if that's realistic to assume right now, but just what is your sense of that argument? How far do you think that's really going to go?
So the opponents of that argument say that this is really about the institutional power of the presidency as opposed to the particular occupant at any given point in time. So this is the argument that's used against that. And as a practical matter, I think you're right, or people are right to suggest that it's not terribly realistic because, as you were saying, the Republicans have a majority. It's a narrow majority, but it is a majority. And so there is very little ammunition that the Democrats have, whether procedurally or in terms of substance, to prevent these hearings from going forward or to prevent confirmation unless, and there's always an outside chance of this, I would say 90-10 that he'll be confirmed, but what if he says something, he has a bad response to a question and it goes viral, which happened to a lower court nominee. I doubt it will happen. Judge Kavanaugh is a very, very brilliant guy and he's been extremely well prepared, but you never know.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh, and David Latt of Above the Law and Byron Tao of The Wall Street Journal are here with me helping to break this down. David, another thing we know about Brett Kavanaugh is that he has indicated that he believes that a sitting president cannot be indicted while in office. Given the political situation today with the president's administration being investigated and all these other issues that are coming to light, what does that mean, or what would that mean, to have someone like Kavanaugh in a Supreme Court seat?
So I actually don't know that it is as problematic as some might think. One issue is that there are Justice Department regulations which currently provide that the Justice Department is not going to indict a president. And special counsel Robert Mueller has indicated he will abide by those recommendations. So in some ways, although it's interesting and perhaps controversial, whether Judge Kavanaugh or Justice Kavanaugh thinks that a president can be indicted is a little bit of an academic point, because I really don't think that Mueller would do that. But I think the second point that others have made and that I agree with is when it comes to these sort of showdowns between the president and the Supreme Court, the Supreme Court doesn't like to look very partisan. The Nixon case, United States versus Nixon, where the court held that Nixon had to give up basically, you know, tapes, other information, that was unanimous. And I think that Chief Justice Roberts, who tries to keep the court above politics, we can debate whether he's done that, but I think he would be very, very reluctant to have a 5-4 split. I think they would try to cobble together some kind of ruling that would get more than 5 votes.
I want to bring up a name here, Merrick Garland. Can you tell us about the different, I'd love to hear both of your thoughts on this, about the sort of different approaches or the politics behind what happened to Garland and what's happening now with Kavanaugh. What's the difference? I mean, that seemed to be pretty obstructive on the part of the Republicans. David?
Well, I think the difference is who has the majority in the Senate. I think that Judge Garland should have received a hearing. He did not receive a hearing when he was nominated by President Obama to replace the late Justice Scalia. But that was really just a function of politics and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell saying, I'm not going to hold a hearing until after the election. So I think in some ways it is just about power.
Thank you so much. David Latt is the founding editor of Above the Law, and Byron Tao is a congressional reporter with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
And today we have big news out of Arizona. Governor Doug Ducey has named a replacement for the late Senator John McCain.
As I contemplated who could best serve our state in the U.S. Senate, I kept coming back to one name and one person, John Kyle.
John Kyle will be more familiar with the role than most. He served as a senator for Arizona from 1995 to 2013 with a solidly conservative voting record. Republicans have been under pressure to name McCain's replacement to give Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh a better chance in a Senate with a razor-thin margin. Kyle is already involved in the confirmation process. Back in August, Fox News reported that he had been helping Kavanaugh by setting up meetings with senators and coaching him through the steps. And if all goes according to plan, John Kyle will be in place before the full Senate votes on Kavanaugh. For people on the U.S.-Mexico border, getting to a hospital is not always an option, including for childbirth. So midwives have been helping deliver babies in the region for decades. And according to the U.S. government, during a period between the 1950s through the 1990s, some midwives provided or sold fraudulent U.S. birth certificates to children actually born on the Mexican side of the border. In recent years, the U.S. State Department has denied passports to some Latinos along the border and called their citizenship into question. Jennifer Carrero is an immigration attorney based in Houston, Texas, representing many clients in that situation, including Edward Garza. And he says he was born in the U.S., but he's been denied a U.S. passport multiple times starting in 2010. And out of concern for his status in the country, we are not using his full name.
Well, the first time I applied, I didn't know anything was wrong. So I just applied. I needed a passport for going out of the country, you know, for a job. And I received that first, and now letter. I never opened it because the job got canceled out of the country. So I didn't pay any mind, really, on the first one.
What type of paperwork did you bring with you to apply?
You know, the birth certificate and Social Security. Had my driver's license, everything. And everything that was required, I brought.
How many times have you tried to apply for a passport, Edward?
It's been four.
Four times, and you've been rejected four times?
Yes. Yes.
What's the reasoning that you're given each time you've been rejected? Is it the same?
Well, yes. It's been that since I was born with by midwife. And it's also stating that she testified under oath that I was not born. Well, I was not born by her under oath. It's a statement.
So the midwife that delivered you testified that she did not deliver you? Is that what happened?
That's what is stating on the letters that I received from the Texas Department.
Mm-hmm. And had you ever been aware of this? Did you have any sense that your birth certificate might be fraudulent?
No, ma'am. None at all.
Jennifer, can you give us a little bit of perspective here in terms of explaining what's actually happening? You know, this story was first broken by the Washington Post, obviously, and the State Department has since responded to this. And of course, our listeners can find the full statement on our website. But the State Department is saying that reporting this is actually inaccurate. They're saying that 28% of passport cases were denied in 2017 compared to 36% in 2015 under the Obama administration. So can you help us understand what exactly is happening here?
Right. So the issue here is, and like I've said, the numbers of percentages don't really mean anything without any sort of relativity. We don't know how many applications there were. We don't know what they consider the midwife issue. Is it any midwife in the country? Is it just the southern border? So the 36 and the 28%, I take with a grain of salt. But ultimately, what's happening is in the southern border, and even in certain other areas, but most predominantly here in Texas, on the southern border in the valley, there were some midwives that delivered babies that were actually born in Mexico, and then later either confessed or were convicted, but it's very few that were actually convicted under our law.
And can you give us a sense, Jennifer, of when, what time period you're talking about, of people who, midwives who were delivering babies on the Mexican border and then lying about whether or not where they were and how they, I mean, it just seems like we're looking for a needle in a haystack. So I just want to really understand the scope of what we're talking about. Was this an organized effort of midwives to do this, or was this just circumstantial?
I think this was money, to be honest with you. I think that it was a way for them to make additional money. It was between about 1950 and 1990, believe it or not. So it did go further into, you know, the century. But I have a list, a fraudulent midwife list at my office that are suspected, convicted, or confessed. And there is about 250 of them. But most of them, I would say a majority, 95% of them actually are just suspected. And how they're suspected is a great question. Why? Why are they suspected? Simply because they were a midwife in southern Texas. And in Edward's case, this woman has supposedly confessed, is what the Department of State is saying, but we also have a statement from her saying that she did deliver him. And we also have a statement from family members that say that they physically saw him be born in the United States. And that's really what the Department of State is looking for, and documentation of mother's prenatal records. Maybe if she worked here, if she was paid. But we know that back then, a lot of times moms did not work, or if they did work, they were not paid properly, like a W-2. So it's very hard to overcome this suspicion just because these women are on this list, and there's no rhyme or reason as to why they're on there if they didn't confess or they weren't convicted.
Edward, what type of impact has this had on your life, if any? Has it affected you at all, or do you just sort of think that this has limited you?
Well, yeah. I mean, now that I'm older, I'm 50. It's had a great impact on me because, like I said, I didn't expect this and not at this age either. Even for work related issues, I can't go out of the country. I had to step down from jobs. Also, it's kind of worrisome that, you know, you might be driving, get pulled over, and get sent to immigration.
Edward Garza is one of the Americans being denied a passport and having his citizenship called into question. And Jennifer Carrero is an immigration attorney based in Houston. Thanks to you both for being with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On Monday, two Reuters journalists were found guilty in Myanmar and sentenced to 7 years in jail. The journalists, Wa Lone and Chu So-woo, were investigating the killings of 10 Rohingya Muslim men and boys when they were arrested and accused of possessing secret state documents. The journalists pleaded not guilty. Joining us to discuss the verdict is Stephen Butler. He's the Asia Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Stephen, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
This is a critical story and devastating verdict for journalists. What's been the reaction from the journalism community, from Reuters, where they're employed?
Well, there's been universal condemnation from journalists around the world, from journalist organizations inside Myanmar, from all kinds of social organizations. Reuters has strongly objected to the verdict. They're planning to appeal. And some members of U.S. Congress are now speaking out. The U.S. ambassador was very vocal in denouncing the verdict. So outside of that courtroom, outside of the judges and the police, there's virtual unanimity that this has been grossly unfair.
The journalists actually said they were set up by police. There was a police captain who backed up their story. There was testimony backing them up. Why was it that this wasn't enough to convince the judge of their innocence? Was this a bigger attack on journalism in the country?
Well, I think it's important to look at what happened to that police officer who verified their story. He's now in jail himself for breaking discipline. So if you're a judge in that system, thinking about exonerating these two journalists, even though the evidence was overwhelming, you have to think about what the future is for yourself, for your family. The reaction of the state has been extremely brutal. And as you suggest, it is not just an attack on these two journalists. It's meant to intimidate all journalists who operate in Myanmar, to prevent them from reporting aggressively on these misdeeds of the military.
Well, and that was my next question, which was, what does this mean for other journalists from other outlets who are trying to cover this conflict?
Well, you have not seen a repetition of this kind of aggressive reporting. These two journalists who went to the Rakhine State, who found these photographs, who dug up sources to verify their story, it hasn't been repeated, and I think there's a good reason for that.
And is this a trend? I mean, we're talking about attacks on journalists. We're seeing this happening in the United States even. We're seeing this happening in Mexico. Is this a growing trend that you're seeing that shows that journalists who are reporting on their own country and the misdeeds of their own country are being more frequently targeted than those who aren't?
Yes, it's unfortunate and true. And last year, at our annual census of journalists in jail, there were 262 journalists in prison, and that's the highest we've ever recorded. This year so far, there have been 39 journalists at least who have been killed in direct relationship to their work. So these are dangerous times for journalists, not only in Myanmar, somewhat in the United States. I mean, the United States still has courts and that will back up freedom of the press. But elsewhere,
in theory, Stephen.
Well, in theory, yes. But overseas, it's become very difficult. I think it's not, and I think there are two big factors behind this. One is that you no longer have leadership from the United States, and the second, you have China's spreading influence. China has shown how to control the media.
Critical information. Stephen Butler is the Asia Program Coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
This week, a Chicago police officer heads to trial.
We have charged Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke with first-degree murder in the connection of the shooting death of Laquan McDonald.
Jason Van Dyke is the first Chicago police officer on record to be charged with murder for an on-duty shooting in almost 40 years. In 2014, Van Dyke fired 16 shots at 17-year-old Laquan McDonald, killing him. The city fought for more than a year to keep footage of the shooting under wraps. According to that footage, McDonald had a knife and was moving away from officers. Just a few hours before the video was finally released, Van Dyke was charged. Here's Mayor Rahm Emanuel speaking back in 2015.
What happened on October 20th, 2014, should never have happened. I take responsibility for what happened because it happened on my watch, and I'm sorry.
Chicagoans flooded the streets in protest. "16 Shots." That's the name of a new podcast examining McDonald's life and death and the impact it's had on the city of Chicago and the nation. It's a collaboration between WBEZ in Chicago and the Chicago Tribune. Jen White is a host at WBEZ and the host of this new podcast, and she joins me now. Hi, Jen.
Hello, Tanzina.
So tell me what the story that you and your colleague, what is the story that you and your colleagues are trying to tell in this new podcast?
We wanted to give people some context around the shooting of Laquan McDonald heading into the trial to really explain what happened that night, to explain what happened afterwards as well. There has been quite a bit of political fallout and some attempts at police reform in the wake of Laquan McDonald's shooting. And we wanted to make sure people had that context and give some insight into the history around the relationship between Chicago police and black and brown neighborhoods.
Now, one of the challenges you and some of the reporters you worked with faced while telling the story is that Laquan's family was reluctant to speak to the press. Can you tell us a little bit about why that was?
You know what? We're not really sure why they haven't spoken to the press. There's been one uncle who has served as a bit of a family spokesman. But what that leaves us with is not a lot of information about who Laquan McDonald was as a person. There are court records that we can refer to that tell, you know, the story of a young man who had some trouble in his life, who had been a foster child that bounced around to about 8 different homes, many of them with different family members. But in terms of who he was, his personality, we had to really do some digging to get to that information.
So the only recording is Laquan's great uncle, Marvin Hunter. Let's take a listen to what he had to say.
I heard people that didn't know him say that he didn't have a family, he was in the system. And I don't have time to go through that whole process of explaining what that was about. But he had family, and he has family, and that's why we're here today to let you know.
So, Jen, why is it so important that Marvin mentioned that about Laquan?
I think because in the telling of this story, initially, you walked away with this idea that no one cared about Laquan McDonald, that he was this kid who sort of was thrown away. And I think it was important to his uncle and to his family to make sure people understood that there are people who loved him. There are people who miss him. His death left a hole in his family and his community.
And soon after McDonald was killed in 2014, police pushed out their narrative of what happened. But then the story unraveled, as we mentioned at the top of the piece. Can you give us a sense of how that came about?
There were several things that happened. The first was that it came to light that there were civilian witnesses at the shooting whose statements weren't taken or who later said they felt pressured to change their statements to fit the police narrative. So that was one aspect. The second was the autopsy of Laquan McDonald's body, and it showed 16 shots that basically Officer Jason Van Dyke emptied his gun into Laquan McDonald. We should also say that he was the only officer on the scene who fired his weapon. Finally, and this came about 13 months after the shooting, after the work of activists and journalists and attorneys, the city was forced to release the video. And what the video showed just didn't match up with the narrative the police had released. And that's how we ended up where we are right now.
So as from a podcast production standpoint, how do you tell the story without having lots of input from Laquan McDonald's family themselves, other than great uncle Marvin Hunter?
You know, one of the things our reporters did, Shannon Heffernan and Patrick Smith, they went to the neighborhood where Laquan McDonald spent a lot of time, and they were able to go into the neighborhood, talk to people, and find two young men who were good friends of Laquan McDonald's. And they talked to them about who he was and helped us get a better understanding of his personality. We were also able to connect with one of his mentors at the school he attended, and she was able to tell us a little bit about him as well. And we did our best to sort of piece together a picture of this young man that you don't get just by looking at the court records.
Now, there was also an interview with Officer Van Dyke. Chicago Tribune reporter was able to interview him. I'm just curious, did you think it would be balanced to include that voice and not more from the family of Laquan himself?
You know, we really wrestled with that question, and we spent months and months gathering up as much audio as we could from people who knew Laquan McDonald to try to make sure we presented a picture that extended beyond the court records that we had access to. In interviewing Jason Van Dyke, what we thought was important was to also challenge some of the statements that he made. It gave us an opportunity to build some context around him as well and to get some insight into the likely strategy his defense team is going to take. So in his interview, there's a moment where he says, I was a good officer. I always de-escalated situations. But when we look then at his personnel file, and we talk about this in the podcast, you see that there were about 20 citizen complaints against him, at least one with racial overtones. You see that there were several lawsuits against him. One citizen was awarded $350,000 for an injury he sustained when Van Dyke cuffed him too tightly. There was also a $5 million payout to the family of Laquan McDonald.
Jen White is an anchor for WBEZ Chicago and host of the new podcast, 16 Shots, which looks into the death of Laquan McDonald. Jen, thank you.
My pleasure.
And we close out this hour with a look at how America's founding document, the Constitution, and the Supreme Court tasked with upholding it impact our public schools every day.
Students do have constitutional rights. The Supreme Court has protected their freedom of speech rights. They've said that they have rights regarding search and seizure. There are rights regarding religion as well. And the Supreme Court for a long time did a good job at protecting those rights. But in recent years, it's my view that the Supreme Court has done a bad job at protecting students' rights.
Justin Driver is a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School and author of the new book, The Schoolhouse Gate, Public Education, the Supreme Court, and the Battle for the American Mind. And he argues that in the interaction of public schools and our Supreme Court is a fundamental understanding of both institutions, and that the Supreme Court has not fulfilled its duty to protect students' constitutional rights to this day.
So the title of the book is The Schoolhouse Gate. And that comes from a decision from 1969 called Tinker versus Des Moines Independent Community School District. And there, a number of students wished to wear black armbands in protest of the Vietnam War. This is in 1965, at a time when the Vietnam War still remained quite popular. And it was an open question whether students had the ability to communicate affirmative views rather than just remaining silent. Did they have the ability to inject their views about major affairs? Educators in Des Moines get wind of this plan to wear black armbands, and they say, this is too upsetting, this is too controversial. We've had a student who died in Vietnam, and this is going to sort of rile up these nasty feelings. And so the Supreme Court issues a decision by Justice Fortas, and he says there, it can hardly be argued that students shed their constitutional rights at the schoolhouse gate. And so that is a decision that probably was not popular in the country as a whole. Nevertheless, the Supreme Court issued it, And it has not done, in my estimation, a good enough job in subsequent years of building upon that basic decision. But the Tinker decision is an incredibly important one.
I want to look a little bit at where we are today, particularly in light of this year's Parkland shootings. And we're seeing more and more student activism coming out of students in schools, whether it's gun-related or not. What are these students' constitutional rights? Are they allowed to walk out in the middle of the day without being penalized if they want to protest something? I just keep thinking of young people who are so engaged right now in the political process that's directly connected to their schooling.
Yeah, the Parkland protests that have happened not just in Parkland but throughout the country is an incredibly important moment. And one of the things that I am in the book trying to resist is this idea that students don't have much to contribute to our cultural discourse. This is an idea that Justice Black actually pushed in the Tinker decision and says that in effect students are there to be seen and not heard. The more persuasive view is that students have played an important role in American society in the form of, you know, protesting the Vietnam War, the civil rights movement. To your specific question about whether students can be punished for walking out of school, it does seem with regret that that is permissible if there are unexcused absences, that if students are leaving and it is an actual protest and the school administrators have not authorized the students, they have the right to speak, but that doesn't mean that they can walk out of the middle of class without permission. If I were a school administrator, of course, I would allow the students to take this symbolic moment because I do think it is important to honor their ability to communicate about these important things. But there are, of course, other measures that they could take, including wearing armbands that would not run afoul of even a sort of harsh school administration or one that is hostile to the viewpoints that they wish to express.
You know, when we think about the Supreme Court and education, I mean, the first case that comes to mind for me is always Brown versus Board of Ed. What are some of the other critical cases that you see that really have affected the development of our school systems today?
If I were to identify a couple of incredibly important opinions that too few people know about, I would look to the Ingram versus Wright decision from 1977, which deals with corporal punishment first and foremost. The single issue that I care the most about in the book is trying to raise awareness of the ongoing issues surrounding corporal punishment. Many people think that corporal punishment has been abolished. It has not. It still exists in this great nation of ours.
You know, Justin, it's interesting that you bring that up because that was going to be my next question, was about school discipline, particularly, and when you mentioned corporal punishment, school discipline and how it's disproportionately meted out to, particularly to Black students. You know, there's been federal data on this repeatedly. I think Black girls in particular and Black boys. What is being done? And we've seen the videos, you know, of law enforcement really handling students of color in particular in egregious ways when it comes to discipline. Is that sort of where you're going with this idea?
Absolutely. You know, in 1977, there were 48 states that permitted corporal punishment. Today, there are fewer than 20. And even that number of states may overstate matters in the sense that a handful of states apply the lion's share of corporal punishment. But just because it exists in a meaningful way in only five states or so doesn't mean that the problem is not a major one. I am in complete agreement with you that the idea that students are being struck with wooden paddles in America in the year 2018 is an abomination, as you suggest. The racial disparities are ugly, and the jurisdictions that retain this practice demonstrate no indication that they are going to abandon this on their own. So I think that this is an area where the Supreme Court of the United States could get involved and say that this violates the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. Public school students are the only group in America that the state can strike with impunity for failing to follow orders or, you know, something like that when they pose no threat to safety whatsoever. So I hope that this book the schoolhouse gate will raise the salience of that issue and motivate the Supreme Court to take another crack at that issue.
Justin Driver is a professor of law at the University of Chicago Law School. Justin, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today. And for our new listeners from New Hampshire Public Radio or anyone new to the show, we want to invite you all to be a part of our listener response network. We're going to send you a few text messages a week about different stories we're covering and ask you to give us your take.
Hi, this is Cindy from DeBerry.
My name is Jeffrey. I'm from Boca Raton.
Michelle calling from Honolulu.
This is Mark from Beaverton, Oregon.
Healthcare is my number one issue.
On average, my total compensation has outpaced cost of living.
Yes, I am considering gun control to be a very important issue.
I really hate those super PACs with a passion.
To sign up, just text the word START to 69866. Standard data and messaging rates apply, and you can always text the word STOP to opt out. Once again, that's text START to 69866 to join our listener response network. You can also join the conversation on The Takeaway's Facebook page or follow me on Twitter. We're at The Takeaway, and I'm at Tanzina Vega. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.